This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome back to Science with Dr. Carl. This week, we get into some big questions. What's actually happening when the wind is knocked out of you? Why does swallowing combat yawning? And could we ever visualize someone else's pain? I'm Lucy Smith. We get into all these questions and more. Plus, we kick off this episode with a sneak peek of something that is going to be dropping in your podcast feeds very soon. An exclusive guest episode with Dave from Glass Animals. Let's get into it. Carl, how you doing?
I'm doing ever so peachy keen.
Now, we've already put you to work this week, Carl, because earlier in the week, we copped a visit from Dave from Glass Animals. Sometimes all I think about is you, late nights in the middle of June. Sing it?
Yep, and he sometimes I think about you. And it's an amazing song because, firstly, it's got a little bit of geography. He talks about being hot and talking June, so that way you know he's in the Northern Hemisphere. Then he's got some real science. He talks about the fake water on the road, you know, when you're getting that reflection. And then, of course, as a really good musician, he has to go to existential angst. Look, I love you, but you'd be better off with somebody else other than me. And it's just a gorgeous song. And, of course, it won number one on the Hottest 100 in 2020, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's actually a friend and fan of the podcast, which we discovered as well. So they landed on our shores earlier this week. Tuesday, they came in to Breakfast with Bryce and Conchetta to announce that they were doing a show tonight. And they actually gave us a list of questions. And they said, you know, if Dr. Carl can answer these, it'd be great. Not expecting that we would get him in the studio with you to ask you the questions himself.
Oh, it was a surprise.
That was a surprise.
Isn't it wonderful having surprises in life?
And you are going to be taken behind the scenes with this as well. So we're going to pop this video up on YouTube of Dave from Glass Animals having complete access to Dr. Carl to ask him a bunch of science questions that he had in the bank from listening to the podcast. And that bonus episode is going to go up on the podcast as well. Should we give a bit of a tease of one of the questions?
But you said podcast, but this is a vodcast because it's got video as well.
Oh my god,
new word, hooray.
We are covering all platforms, Dr. Carl. So there's a bunch of different questions he asked. You'll be the first to know if you are subscribed on your preferred podcast app. You'll be the first to know when that episode drops. But this is just one of the questions that Dave from Glass Animals wanted to know.
Space is a vacuum. And I was wondering if you could propel yourself, if you really had to, you're stuck in space, if you could just fart and move yourself towards the spaceship.
Luckily, we've actually done the experiment.
You did it yourself?
No, I haven't been in space. But the astronaut Chris Hadfield had tried using farts for propulsion on the International Space Station, and he said, and I quote, he found it too muffled, comma, with not the right type of propulsive nozzle, unquote. So you do get a very small motion, which if you fart, you'll be moving yourself at roughly 1,000th the rate at which your hair grows.
Okay.
And you can't aim it all that well, but yes, theoretically, if you've got enough time, you can propel yourself around by using farts.
That was just one of the questions that he asked. And Dr. Carl, he had some big ones about the universe, about aliens.
Yeah, like it really came back to that old saying in physics, it's not the answer that gets you the Nobel Prize, it's the question. And the most important thing about the world, I think, no, it's not the most important thing, but if you want to become a scientist, the most important thing is to be able to ask questions. And so look at a situation and look at it in a different way and say, why is the grass green instead of black? Because according to the grown-ups, grass runs on photosynthesis. It absorbs sunlight. So if it's black, it would absorb more sunlight, but it's green. And in fact, it's actually reflecting most of the sunlight. And then you ask the question and everything flows.
Exactly. So if you want to listen or watch this bonus episode with Dave from Glass Animals asking Dr. Carl a bunch of science questions, make sure you are subscribed on both YouTube and wherever you listen to the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. And I think what this is a reminder of is that, you know, Dave from Glass Animals took this opportunity while he was in the country. But people get to ask you questions every week, Dr. Carl.
Oh, this is the moral lesson from the big to the small, as above, so below. I'm feeling very Buddhist right now.
Absolutely. So let's get into these questions. We've got Lisa from Melbourne who's going to kick us off. Lisa, talk us through your desk situation at work. What's the battle here?
Hi, Lucy. Hi, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Lucy.
Just wondering, I've got a new sit-stand desk at work and I stand most of the day. But I have a care worker who has told me that if I'm to eat my lunch at my desk, I should sit down so that my body can process the food properly. Is that true, or is that like a wise term?
Lisa. Yeah, not Lucy, Lisa. Yes and no. If you have to, you can process the food mechanically, but emotionally, a different thing. So I remember back in the old days, we used to have morning tea where everybody would stop and meet and have a cup of tea together, and in the afternoon and in lunch. And in France, there is actually a whole designated hour or two for lunch. And so on one hand, you've got the extreme of, I'll keep on eating while I'm here, and the IT people get really angry because little particles of food end up in the keyboard, blah, 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 blah. But on the other hand, there's the emotional side where this is your time. It's written into the Australian Workplace Agreement or whatever it is. I'm just making those words up. But there is some sort of legal requirement that you have lunch. And it's good to have this time to spend with people. So, sure, if you've got a deadline, which should happen once every year and no more than that, yeah, you can eat at your lunch, but you're missing out on all the other good things that go along with it, you know, the emotional connection with people. Is that kind of fitting in, Lisa?
Yeah, I go for a walk in my lunch break instead with my colleagues, so I get that time and that connection and away from the office.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, come back and sit down and eat by myself.
Yeah.
So just confirming, sitting and standing doesn't really, it's not compressing the stomach in any way that affects, or extending the stomach in any way that affects how the food is digested?
It might. There's a thing in the brain called the vagus nerve, and vagus literally means wandering, like I wandered over the hills, free as a cloud, and it wanders through the whole body, and it seems to affect all sorts of stuff, and it's related to the gut, and there does seem to be this vibe that you should be relaxed when you eat and you make your brain happier. And the whole sitting, standing thing, overwhelmingly, sitting all day is not good for you. And a standing thing is good. But I do hope you've got the keyboard at the right height and you've got a little rest for your wrists, so that your keyboard, you're resting your wrists on the little armrest, so you're not putting stress on your shoulder. And you got a little rest for the mouse as well. And the screen is at your eye height. You're not having to look up or down. Is that right as well?
Yes, yeah, the whole desk raises.
Yeah. Okay, right. So the ergonomics is really good.
Lisa, I love that this went from a question maybe about digestion to Dr. Cole hoping that you are socialising on your lunch break, that your wrists are at the right movement and that your standing desk is correct.
Yes.
This is Dr. Cole. He's so caring.
Oh, I just want you to be happy, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
We've got Pat from Oran Park here. Now, Pat, talk us through your question.
So we're different to a lot of other species and even to ourselves. So my question is, with likes and dislikes, what mechanical or chemical part of our brain says, I like this food, not that food, I like this music, not this music. We like people, our partners, instead of just mating to multiply. Like, when does that all come into it?
Well, firstly, you've got your DNA and you've got your individual differences there right from your genetics. And there's these occasional really weird cases of twins, identical twins, who get separated at birth and they marry people with the same name almost at the same age and have the same number of kids and drive the same car and then separate or divorce from that person. So there's something going on in your DNA. You've got to account for that. And then that's followed by your influences while you're growing up. And there was one terrible case where before the Second World War, two identical twins got separated and one ended up being a very Jewish person in religion and the other one ended up being a Nazi. They got separated in their families and then there's a whole lot of stuff from that. And then there's the whole intellectual side. Oh, I don't like this music because it's too fast or it's too slow. And then there's the emotional side and then there's the social bonding side. And then to tie that to something in the brain where you can say, is this part of the brain that does something or is this hormone? No, it's much more complicated than that. So the one that is really annoying me, I get cranky about it, is they say, oh, it's because I got too much dopamine or serotonin. And I remember when I was a drug-crazed hippie, there was one neurotransmitter in the brain, which was acetylcholine. By the time I started medicine, there are about 10. By the time I finished, there were about 100. And it's like a tangled spaghetti. And to try and say, oh, it's dopamine that does this. So your likes and dislikes are a whole complicated mess, like a bag of worms. We just can't untangle them.
Wow. So true, because it's so much about your community and who you surround yourself with and who you're friends with. You know, because a lot of people, I think we get that question a lot when it comes to music taste and things like that. But, you know, if you grew up with a sibling who loved metal, you might like metal too, and that's just how it is.
Unless
you know?
You hated that sibling.
Yeah, true. And you hated hearing the noise coming from their room.
Noise, not the beautiful music, but the noise because you didn't like them.
That's so interesting.
We should all love each other.
Love each other, man. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you, Dr. Pat.
Now, we've got Kelly in Gingin. Kelly, you got a question about eyes.
I do. Hi, doctors.
Hi.
Dr. Kelly.
Yes. The other day we were outside and the bats were going past. A few landed in the tree close to us, so we shone a torch up and their eyes were glowing red.
Aha.
Then we've also got a dog, so we shone the torch on the dog and the eyes were glowing like a white or a blue.
Ah.
And I just wondered the reason for the different colours in the different animals' eyes.
Ah. So the bats were red, like humans.
Yeah.
Ah, but so the dog was white.
Yeah, so
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Here's a magic word, tapetum, T-A-P-E-T-U-M, which is a kind of reflective layer. So you've got an eyeball, which if you're over the age of 12 is about 24 millimetres or an inch in the old money in diameter. On the inside of it, your eyes, is a layer called the retina, and it turns the incoming light into electricity, it gets processed, blah, 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 full 3D colour vision, blah, 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 blah. In the case, in most animals, evolution made a mistake, and the blood vessels are at the front. Oh, my God, that's so stupid. The squids have got it better. They've got the blood vessels at the back. And what that means is you're thinking, hang on, the blood vessels that feed my retina are in front of my retina. How come I don't see them? Well, firstly, there's an electronic system in your brain that automatically wipes them out. So there's all these little micro black spots in your vision, and you compensate with it for other cells around. That's one thing that happens. And with certain animals like dogs and cats, they've got a shiny layer at the back.
Mm.
So the blood vessels are at the front. Oh, by the way, you can see the blood vessels by... on a day when it's nice and sunny, go out into the front lawn, close your eyes, stare at the sky, and just sort of defocus. And then suddenly you'll see like a little pipe with little ball bearings going in it. And what you're seeing are the red blood cells going inside the blood vessels in front of your retina.
Hmm.
Getting back to
you
and me, okay? Getting back to you and me, you got all the blood vessels in front, and you say it's your dog, so you shine a light, and then you just get you see inside the eyeball, the iris doesn't close down fast enough because the flash is really fast. But in cats, you said it's your dog is white, okay? So the bat is red and we're red, so we've got the blood vessels in front. The dog and the cat, they've got this tapetum layer, which is a shiny layer at the back. And that means that they're more nocturnal animals that use their eyes. Bats are nocturnal animals that use their ultrasound.
Oh.
They don't need to use their eyes. So with the cats and the dogs, the light goes through the blood, through the cells in the retina that turn light into electricity, and I might miss one. And then it's got this shiny layer and it has a second go. It gets bounced forward. That doubles the efficiency. You're losing a little bit of sharpness, but you are picking up that there's something moving over there. So the reason that their eyes are red is that they don't bother using their eyes for vision at night because they've got this wonderful ultrasound.
Ah, there you go.
Oh,
awesome.
Oh. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, Doctor.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Kelly. That was wonderful. I hadn't had a chance to say the word tapetum for at least a year.
Yeah, new word, Dr. Carl.
Very good.
Harry from Narracourt next. And Harry, your question relates to something you heard on Drive with Abby and Tyrone. Now, they were talking about a big event that we're putting on with Bars of Steel Live. This is a radio segment that we are taking to the streets. And this is how they described it on the show yesterday.
Something that is going to bring an element of Triple J and to the IRL.
What?
Yeah, into the third dimension, 3D. It's like happening in front of you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, no, I know
it's
what you're saying.
It's making it real.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, I mean, two-dimensional is like, yeah, it's like...
It's like paper.
Yeah, it's like paper. Yeah, oh, God. So, listen to the scholars that we have on this station.
So, Harry, off the back of this, you were a bit inspired. What's your question?
G'day, doctors. My question is, what's the meaning between the one, the two, the three, and the four dimensionals on Earth and in the cosmos as well.
Oh, it is something that we could possibly use as a transport system in your lifetime, bearing in mind the following, that between 1903 and 1969, one human lifetime, 66 years, we went from not being able to fly to go to the moon and back. And, just before we answer your question, when the universe started up, there were almost certainly 12 dimensions, and 8 of them went away, and we can't find them, but we will be able to find them at some stage. Maybe this century, maybe next century, it might be bigger than that. It might take 2 human lifetimes. But let's just start off at the beginning. So one dimension is a point. So imagine that you've got a bit of paper and you've got the sharpest pencil you can think of and you make a little tiny dot and the dot is so small you can't see it, but you know it's there. Mm. That is one dimension. By the way, that's a black hole. All black holes have the same size, which is zero. They're just a one-dimensional point in space. And it doesn't matter whether they have a mass of 5 times the mass of the sun or 50 or 500 or 5,000 or 50 billion. The actual size is zero. It hurts your head. Just believe it. Go along with it. Accept it. The kids will accept it. They'll be with it. They'll be playing with black holes. So a one-dimensional thing is just... Oh, no, that's zero dimension. A one-dimensional thing is a line. It's just a line of zero thickness on paper. A two-dimensional thing goes backwards, forwards, and left, right. So one dimension, I lied at the beginning, sorry. So zero dimensions is a black hole, a point. One dimension is a line, it goes backwards, forwards. Two dimensions is backward, forward, and left, right. That's a sheet of paper. Three dimensions is backwards, forwards, and left, right, and up and down.
Mm.
And there we were thrown in a fourth dimension of time, and Einstein worried about this in 1905, and he kind of proved that time is married to the three dimensions of space. But while he was a brilliant idea person, he wasn't that good a mathematician. I mean, he was good. He was really good, but he wasn't brilliant. He was brilliant at ideas. So he teamed up with Minkowski in 1908, who was a brilliant mathematician, and then they proved that time is what we call the fourth dimension. And then there's all these other dimensions that are there, but we can't find them with today's technology. Mm-hmm. So as an example of problems, we have the problems with dark matter. 25% of the universe almost certainly will solve that in the next couple of decades. Dark energy, 75% of the universe that is making the universe expand faster than it should, almost certainly will solve that in maybe, I don't know, a couple of decades. Black holes. Mate, there should be a billion black holes in our galaxy and we've found 36. Where are they? And I'm pretty sure, Dr. Harry, that at some stage you'll say to your niece when you're a lot older, hey, Rebecca, stop playing with the black hole and come in and have lunch. And then there's the missing dimensions of the universe. These are all problems that will be solved, but we just don't know when, but sometime. Has that given you a bit of an introduction to dimensions, Dr. Harry?
Yes, it does. And yes, I do have a niece and yes, I'd be quite scary when she's playing with black holes.
So would you say that Abby and Dave there are apt in describing a radio segment that we hear radio waves of being mm-hmm. taken into the real world?
IRL.
Is that 1D to 3D, would you say?
Oh, actually that'd be almost, oh, because the weird thing is that the sun sends us 1.5 kilowatts of power per square meter through empty space, not through copper wires. They travel through, okay, so they're traveling through three dimensions. So they do appear in three dimensions or four dimensions if you want to account the fact that time clocks on at 1 second per second. So you can interchangeably say three dimensions for space and four dimensions if you want to throw in time. So I thought that their description was absolutely really good.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I loved it.
All right, sweet.
It's hard. I got it wrong with zero dimensions. The point is zero dimensions. I got it wrong, yeah. Okay.
We've given science to the Bars of Steel live event. I love that. If you want to know what we're talking about, what is going down and how you can potentially get there, head to Triple J's Instagram. You will
see. And
where
is it at?
Oh, that's the thing. It's a bit of a secret.
Oh, it's a secret.
Secret location. All the details you can check out now. It's pinned at the top of Triple J's Instagram. Harry, thank you for your question.
Thank you, Dr. Harry.
We've got Jenny right here. Now, Jenny, what's your question for Carl?
Dr. Hi, Jenny. Sorry.
Hi, Dr. Jenny. We love you.
Hi, Jenny. Hi, Lucy.
sitting here going a bit nuts. I just wondered if we'll ever be able to measure, visualize, or feel someone else's physical pain.
That's really interesting because I did a podcast about long COVID with a pain scientist. And so now I've got him, I'm going to ask him. He told me this weird story about a woman who discovered that she didn't feel pain and she didn't know it until they were English, was walking on a holiday in one of the countries that they occupied, Scotland. Oh, I've got to get into trouble for saying that. And they were on a holiday and she slipped on the mud, walking, you know, and it's muddy. And she slipped and fell on her face and there was a bit of blood. And he's saying, oh, don't like the look of that. She said, oh, it's getting better. And I feel all right. Yeah, so they kept on walking. And at the end of the day, he said, look, let's just go and check it out at the local hospital. And he'd come back at the end of their day-long walk. And the doctor in the hospital said, yeah, look, your face is okay, but do you know you got a broken arm? And she said, oh, it's a bit swollen. And he said, yeah, look, definitely it's swollen, but do you notice that it's bending the wrong way?
Oh, my gosh.
And she said, oh, yeah, it is actually bending the wrong way. Yeah, it is. I'm making this bit up here. I'm trying to sort of personalize it. Mm. And he said, look, I'd just like to press somewhere where I think it might hurt, but I'll do it very gently and work up. And he pressed until he was pressing like he was pressing on a bar of steel and saying, no, don't feel a thing. She had no pain.
Wow.
That's how she discovered, as an adult, married, that she had no pain. And then they took her into surgery. Now, part of anesthetics is that you make somebody unconscious. And another part is that you give them pain relief, you know, opiates, all that sort of stuff. Because if you don't, the pain will wake them up from unconscious. In this case, he said, well, is it okay if we just give you the anesthetic but no pain relief? And explained why. And she said, sure. Mate, she didn't feel any pain.
What?
Okay, getting back to your question, Dr. Jenny, what you're trying to do is transfer a huge amount of information. So if you do an EEG, electroencephalograph, on a person's brain, you put maybe 24 electrodes on their brain and you get all these different waves. And then if you want, you can do an MRI scan, but an fMRI. F stands for functional and you're looking at what parts of the brain are working and you can see these areas that are maybe like 2 millimetres in size lighting up. Mate, you don't want 2 millimetres, you want 2 millionths of a metre. And you want to be able to analyse the chemicals and there are hundreds of them and there's all this and there's magnetic fields. At some stage I reckon we'll be able to do it, but this is a lot harder than discovering dark energy, dark matter, black holes, or the other dimensions. The human brain is going to be a bigger problem to solve than just simple things like where did the universe come from? So bearing in mind it's very difficult to predict the future, the answer is yes, but I don't know when. Is that making you happy, Jenny, or not, or sorry?
Not really. It's just, it's unfortunate. It always seems so very unfair that if you've got, you know, a broken arm or something, people can see you're in distress. But if you've got something like, chronic fatigue or things like that, people have no idea.
And, chronic fatigue.
Just tends to get ignored. Mm. Yeah.
So, if they could see it, then maybe it would, yeah.
So the way I was taught by a clever doctor when I was fairly junior was if you want to feel somebody's pain, get them to put your finger on their sore spot. Mm. And then they control your finger and press. You don't press, they press. And you can tell by how hard they're pressing how bad the pain is.
Oh.
So if they're just sort of putting their finger on you, on them with the weight of a sheet of paper and they say, oh, that hurts, you think, oh, that's really bad pain. Mm. But if they press and press and press and you can feel your finger getting squashed, then the pain's not that bad. But honestly, I really want something that we can feel people's pain.
We've got Emma in Tasmania. Emma, your friend is sneezing, but at a particular junction. What's going on?
Yes. Morning, doctors.
Emma,
so
welcome.
Every time my friend drinks wine, she sneezes. So I was wondering if this could be some sort of histamine-type allergy response.
Mm. What type of wine?
Any.
Is she a red or white gal?
Either. Red, white, and the sneezing continues the whole time she's drinking wine.
Other forms of alcohol?
No.
Really? Okay, here's a magic word, congeners, C-O-N-G-E-N-E-R-S. And they refer to chemicals that are not alcohol, but they're part of the flavour experience. And the congeners in the wines, red, white, rosé, are different from the congeners elsewhere. Almost certainly it's one of those congeners, and I don't know which one it would be. And the way to find out, which I should have done, was to either go onto Google Scholar. Have you heard about Google Scholar, Emma?
Yep.
Okay, so you go into Google Scholar and then you ask in there and then you spend a couple of hours and you'll find it's almost certainly a described but uncommon thing happening to some people. But all I can say is that sneezing is such an important reflex. You have to sneeze because otherwise crud goes into your lungs and never comes out. And in her case, it's being triggered, unfortunately, and I'm guessing, by these congeners, but which ones they are, I don't know. I don't know how to cure it either. I mean, how sad that you can't enjoy a beautiful red wine.
Without sneezing.
Or white wine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, more sneezing. For me, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Thanks, Emma.
Thank you, Emma.
Thanks.
Rocky from Leeton here. Rocky, what do you want to know?
I was just wondering, what happens when you get the wind knocked out of you and what does it feel like forever to get your breath back?
It's scary, isn't it?
I remember it happening to me when I was 9 years old and I was running along and then my dog foolishly ran in front of me. Aww. It was normal. The dog was right, I was wrong. And I fell over and it's never happened since, but I really felt like I was going to die because I had no control. I'm lying on the ground and that's okay. A bit of pain, no big deal. But I wanted to breathe and I could not breathe. And it seemed like forever, but almost certainly it was more maybe 15 seconds. What about for you, Lucy? Have you had it happen to you?
Yeah, I remember once, I think it was on a trampoline and just... And it's really scary. Oh. But it hasn't happened to me recently, touch wood.
And what about you, Rocky? Has it happened to you?
Yeah, it happened to me on the weekend. I fell off my motorbike and rolling around on the ground for, felt like half an hour, but... For only 5 minutes, but wondering.
5 minutes without air?
Oh, probably not that long. But
Well, I think the world record is something like 20 forever. Minutes or something. Now, do you, this is me doing the nanny thing, do you have the proper leather gear and the Kevlar pads on your shoulders and the hump in the middle of your back and on your elbows and on your knees?
I do, yeah.
Were
do.
You wearing them?
Not at the time, no.
Mate, let me tell you how once we this is how you get rid of a gravel rash on somebody when they've been in a motorbike accident and they weren't wearing the proper leathers. You take them into theatre. You make them unconscious. You get a stainless steel brush and you start brushing. Okay, right? You with me here? You're going to wear your leathers now, aren't you, Rocky?
Yeah.
Thank you, Rocky. Okay, to answer your question. So the answer is this. When you fall, you suddenly get a spike of high pressure in your lungs. Yep. This then transfers itself onto your diaphragm muscle. We'll talk about that in a minute, and sends it into a spasm. Now, I'm sure you've probably had a leg cramp, Lucy, where you can't stretch it or extend it and it just hurts like crazy. Okay, you're having a cramp, but on your diaphragm muscle. A bit of background here. So your chest cavity, the thing that runs from your neck to the top of the legs, has got two major cavities. Above the bottom of the ribs, you've got the lungs. The heart's in there, don't worry about that. And below that, you've got your gut. And the diaphragm is a muscle, the membrane that separates them, and it's curved. And when it contracts, it goes straight. And then it pulls the bottom of your lungs down, you've got your mouth open, air comes in. So it's the spike that comes through of, we think, of high pressure air, where you just had a sudden shockwave go through your lungs, that sets off a spasm in your diaphragm and then it just stays like that. And you can do things like physically bend your body at the middle. So if you're lying flat, sit up straight. And then if you're sitting up straight, lie flat, and that can help relieve it. But almost it always comes that you start breathing okay in another minute or so at the most.
Yeah.
Wow, scary though the first time it happens.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I was so scared and terrified.
Thanks, Rocky.
Thank you, Dr. Rocky.
Thank you.
And wear your leathers.
Wear
your leathers. You don't want a stainless steel brush on you in an operating theatre.
We got Tony in Perth here. Tony, got a question about animals.
I do. Hi, doctors. How are you?
Dr. Tony, welcome.
Thank you. So my question, and my daughter's, is do animals have a dominant side like humans do?
Yes, insofar as we've gone looking here and there. So firstly, how do you measure it? So if you've got a dog, you offer it a treat or a toy that it likes to play with, does it use its left paw or its right paw? Mm. And the other way to measure it is the stepping test. Hear over, and it comes to you taking off on its right foot or its left foot, and you see how consistent it does that. It turns out that in the dog land, females tend to be right-handed, right-pawed, and the males tend to be left-pawed. And overall, in dogs, it's sort of like one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third right-handed, one-third left-handed, one-third ambi. But there is a tendency for them to have a preferred side. And you do have two sides of your brain that are almost separate. So you've got about 40 billion nerves on one side of your brain and 40 billion on the other. And in between is a little pathway of only a couple of, few tens of millions of nerves. And you can end up with weird things when one side of the brain is not talking to the other. But we have two separate brains in our head and they work together really well. And the whole handedness thing is complicated. So I might just stop there. Do you have a follow-up comment or question?
No, not really. That's pretty much what we wanted to know.
Great. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Tony. And you say it was your daughter. Thank you, daughter.
Yeah.
Do you
have a pet, Dr.
I used to have, but now I have children and nieces and nephews and stuff, and they take up more time. On the other hand, the advantage of a pet is you get more sleep.
Why?
Because they don't wake you up at 2 o'clock in the morning for no good reason whatsoever.
Oh, true. But people with cats, they get woken up sometimes at 5 in the morning.
I dream of being I have driven my son from Sydney to Wollongong and back again. I have driven my daughter Lola around when they were building the Olympic Park in the year 2000 for the Olympic Games in Sydney and got busted by the full terror squad.
What do you mean?
So it's about 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm driving around in circles and I suddenly end up at Olympic Park and I think, okay, I'll do loops. And I'm sort of driving around in circles around the Olympic Park that they're building. And obviously they're thinking there's this person driving around in circles. Hey, this is a chance to practice our anti-terror activities. Suddenly out of nowhere, there's bloody helicopters, armoured vehicles, cars coming at me from all directions, and they're all coming at me at high speed. And they're saying, stop, what are you doing? What are you doing? And they're shouting at me really loud, which is part of the whole protocol of trying to assert dominance. And I wound down the window and I said, quietly, you're waking the baby.
Oh, yeah. <laughs> And
they said, oh, yeah. And they started shouting at me. I said, you're waking the baby. And one of them who had a kid said, hang on, and looked in the back. Oh, there's a baby. And he turned around to the other one and said, oh, he's just walking, taking the baby for a walk. And then they all backed off. And
you're like, thanks a lot.
And
she's
didn't
no
wake
threat.
Up. Yeah, and she didn't wake up.
We're going to get to one last question before we take another track. Sam in Adelaide, what do you want to know?
Dr. Sam.
Hi. Sorry. Hi, Dr. Carl. I have a question that I've been unable to Google because it's oddly specific. And basically, I discovered this neat little trick where if I'm about to yawn and I just swallow a bit of spit, it somehow stops me from yawning. And I was just wondering, like, how does that actually work? Do you know how that works?
No, but we've got a hint. I've been a big fan of yawning for a long time, and swallowing is something that we all do. And there was a paper in 2013, 14, 15, which found that there's a link between yawning and swallowing. And if you yawn, then there's a 5 times increase in how much you swallow in the next 10 seconds and roughly the other way around. So yawning and swallowing, we have discovered from this paper, are linked in the brain and there's a bit of a time delay. And so presumably those parts of the brain work against each other when you're trying to do one or the other. If you don't want to yawn, if you do a swallow, that'll inhibit it, but we don't know why. What we do know is that they're linked. And we probably don't know more about it because it's not some sort of fatal condition that exists in humans. I yawned myself to death. I swallowed myself to death. I don't know.
And if you are listening to this right now and you have the urge to yawn or you feel like yawning, we've done a video on this, Dr. Carl, which you can check out via Triple J's TikTok. Now, we had someone call us recently, Dr. Carl, a few breaks ago about their friend who tends to sneeze when they drink wine, and it's any wine. Joe has texted in on Durable Country saying, wine contains sulfites in the fermenting process, but winemakers also add sulfur dioxide, which can cause side effects on people. Check the ingredients for how much sulfites each wine contains.
I completely forgot about that. Thank you so much.
And I just Googled sulfur dioxide, and it said that one of the, not a huge amount, but one of the symptoms of it can be sneezing.
Oh, thank you.
Joe, thank you so much. We've got Ross from Deniliquin here. Ross, what's your question?
Dr. Ross.
Yeah. I was just wondering if we knew of an earliest point in the timeline of the universe that life would have developed.
Earth was formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and we have pretty definite proof, in inverted commas, wave your hands a lot, that we had life at 3.8 billion years. So that's 0.7 of a billion years, or 700 million years. And that's the big mystery there. How do inanimate chemicals form themselves into a creature that makes babies? If you look at the simplest bacterium you can find, all you find is chemicals. You don't find some sort of magic here be life thing. So we've got fairly good proof of 700 million years, and I reckon it'd be shorter than that. But we still don't understand how life came. What is your thinking on this one, Dr. Ross?
Well, I sort of was thinking more from the physics standpoint of, we know time frames for like the composition of atoms and all of that sort of stuff. And I guess I was thinking it would have been before the Earth was around, because the universe is much, much older than the Earth.
Okay, but, so yeah. We had hydrogen and helium at 380,000 years. We had the first full sets of elements all the way up to uranium, say a couple of hundred million years. So I reckon sometime after that. But then I, having read too much science fiction, tend to think that the stars are alive, and that stars have electrons. Electrons can spin this way and that. That counts as a one or a naught. You can mimic artificial intelligence inside a regular computer, which works on ones and noughts. So stars could be alive, and they're not aware of us being alive in the same way that the bacteria on our skin, which live for 20 minutes, are not aware that we're alive. So what is life? Yeah, what is life? We've got no idea.
What is life? Thanks, Ross.
Thank you, Dr. Ross.
No worries.
We've got Alex in
Perth. Sorry.
Sorry, Ross. Yep. Hey, Alex, what's your question?
Alex, Dr. Alex, welcome.
Morning, doctors. I had a pretty hard-hitting science question.
Oh, good.
Just in terms of washing dishes with hot water, have I become conditioned to always use it? You know, like 90% of the time, I wash my hands with cold water and soap.
Yep.
But why not dishes?
The standard thinking is that the rate of a chemical reaction doubles for every 10 degrees C rise in temperature. So one advantage of using hot water is that more quickly you can remove the crud off the dishes, assuming you're washing it in the sink. The other thing is that you've got to have it hot to kill the germs, but you can't have it hot enough to kill the germs, really, because you've got to have 70 degrees centigrade to kill the germs. And you know, like if you cut some meat or something. And so 50 degrees is the most you can do. So there might be some, look, what we really need is a microbiologist to ring in next week and talk us through this one. That is a deep one. You've hit us with a heavy hitting one there, Alex. I'm not qualified to give the depth on this.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, microbiologist, ring in next week. Why do you have to use hot water? Okay.
Next. I once had someone over for dinner, and they did the thing where they off, oh, I'll clean up. Anyway, and they just washed the dishes with cold water and a sponge. And they said, that's all you need to do. You don't need hot water and you don't need soap. It made me so uncomfortable. As soon as they left, I put it all in the dishwasher.
But okay, if you hold the dish to the light and if it gives you an even reflection, they've probably removed all the fat.
No.
And really, you're not going to... Yeah, okay, I'm with you. It's yucky. It's irrational. I'm happy to be irrational.
Dr. Carl, that's all we've got time for, can you believe?
What?
Someone sent in a question saying, why is the Dr. Carl hour the fastest hour of my work week?
What do you mean hours? 3 minutes. It just went.
I know, because it's so much fun.
Oh.
Carl, I'm obsessed with you. If you want to hear Dave from Glass Animals be obsessed with Dr.
My BFF.
Carl, your new BFF,
yep.
We have a bonus episode going up in the podcast feed today where Dave had access to Dr. Carl for 20 minutes and asked him a bunch of questions which he'd saved up because he's a fan of the podcast, which is so exciting. International love. So good. So if you want to listen to that, make sure you are subscribed to be the first to know when it drops, both on YouTube and on your preferred podcast service. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy keen.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Remember to like, subscribe, rate, review, everything we need to stay in your orbit so you can be the first to know when a new episode drops. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Robbie Armfield and Max Laverne, and we'll catch you next week. Bye!
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.